This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's Geek Squawks. My name is Jeff Sandu. Together with Culture Pop's Matt Armitage, we talk about smart cities often, and I do a lot of interviews with people who are, you know, the brains behind this development of smart cities, whether it's in Malaysia, Singapore, the world. But what's interesting, I came across an article by the American Civil Liberties Union on how to stop smart cities becoming surveillance cities. Because when you think about it, you know, all these new technologies that enables a smart city, a city to become smart, is using cameras. Then that could be like, you know, whether it's keeping track of traffic and helping you to navigate better, you know, things like Waze, but putting it into the next step. Or it could even just be like, you know, when to know the, you know, the rubbish bins are full, or where do you find the easier parking spaces. All this is on the go.
Yeah, and we're already seeing, I mean, you mentioned the rubbish bins. Now, the sensors in rubbish bins, they do tell that they're full. Mm. But in, I think in the UK, they're also using them, they link them to a digital scale. So if you throw away more rubbish than you are allowed to in a given week in terms of weightage, you then get a fine, which is automatically registered from your waste bin.
And that is where the problem begins. Because it's now slowly becoming into a surveillance city. We talk about China and how their, you know, social credit score rating system that they have. It's just, you know, they came out very clear about what they're doing. Every other smart city seems to be just talking about its benefits and
yeah,
stuff.
It's
but
a,
you
it's
know,
a bit woolly, right? Yeah.
It's a little bit more than just helping the citizens to navigate their city better, because clearly they're using this data for something else and they're not being clear about it.
Well, also, I mean, we were talking about on Matt's Blend last week about how companies like Amazon can use payment gateways potentially as tracking mechanisms. So when you fit all of that information into these cities, if you have cameras everywhere, if you have information on point of sale terminals, that is an incredibly detailed picture of every single thing you do from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to sleep.
Yeah.
Because we put sleep trackers on our phones.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have to understand where all of this data goes, where all of this information is being controlled, and who is actually overseeing it and how it's being used.
You know, recently my phone has been asking me, did you sleep from 11:30 p.m. till 7 in the morning? And then, like, you know, following day, it'll ask me again, did you fall asleep at 10:30 p.m. till 4 in the morning? And I'm like creeping out because I'm like, how do you know? Because I never use my phone when it's past 9 p.m. So how does it know? And I just refuse to say, yes, I did, or no, I didn't. I just turned off the notifications. I don't want to see this anymore.
Maybe it's because your Netflix is going into pause, or your Spotify is going into pause. You know,
it could be that. Yeah,
but that's what I'm saying. I mean, I'm not saying that either of those companies are doing anything like this. But that is the kind of picture that we start to build up, because you know, as you were pointing out in the beginning, all of these individual things, we think of them as individual things, but data is not an individual thing. It can all be channeled into the same place and analyzed to create an incredibly lucid picture.
Mm. So here's a solution. And this was, you know, came out from ACLU. They led this campaign called the Community Control Over Police Surveillance, or CCOPS. And they have managed to get through about 7 local CSOP laws that would require an oversight of getting this information out to the public before any of these projects are executed. So the governments and the policymakers, they have to state what exactly are they going to be using this before they implement this project, because the after effects is always just then, you know, going backwards. You're stepping backwards to try and undo what has already been done. Mm. So they've came up with this thing where, you know, and they're encouraging people from, you know, even here, probably in Malaysia, we're talking about, you know, smart city in Selangor and in other parts of Malaysia as well. It's like, let's probably work with the regulations, the policy side first before, because the technology is available already.
The
we can do this now.
Easy. Yeah. Yeah.
But it's like, let's just make it clear, what are we using this for first?
The governance and the privacy is incredibly important. I mean, just to give people an example of the kind of data streams that you don't think of producing a picture for you. As more and more of us are moving to these kind of smart home hubs, potentially you could have information being relayed about the amount of time it takes for you to finish your smoothie, to blend your smoothie, and the moment where you start your car. So, you know, there are these incredibly detailed pictures. If you start using, again, if you've got light switches hooked up to these hubs, how long do you spend in the bathroom?
Yeah.
What journey do you take through your home? And that journey then follows you when you leave the home and you go into other places. We all use loyalty cards with RFIDs on them. You know, all of these incredible things that make our lives easier also create, as you were saying, this kind of culture of surveillance, which if we're not aware of, people can very easily subvert.
So this model builds provisions include a transparent approval process that will require public disclosure, open hearings, and also a sign-off from elected officials on all surveillance technologies and the specific ways in which they intend to use them. It also requires a publicly released surveillance impact report that includes a potential adverse effects on civil liberties and civil rights. So I guess, again, it needs to be clear, and this report is so crucial.
Well, it needs to be clear, but it's also worth pointing out that when we talk about smart cities and we talk about open data, very often when it comes to that moment where the data is dealt with, that's where smart cities get a little bit dark about what's actually happening with that information, because they start citing security risks and all that kind of thing. But they're forgetting that it's not their data, it's our data. And again, that's why this is being pushed by the ACLU, the Civil Liberties Union, and it's why it's so important for us to think about, not just in a North American context, but in a global context.
Yeah, it is a global issue. And I guess, you know, it's just a good refresher, because just yesterday, you know, I did an interview talking about smart cities and where do we draw the line. And, you know, today here, you know, I come across this article and we're like, I think we need to really look at, you know, policy making and get them to be clear. Let's, you know, get out all these reports and, you know, let's talk about the impact of all these technologies happening. Because like we said, technology is already here. We could actually implement, we can make smart city here in KL today itself if you want to, but, you know, push back slowly, do it by stages, right?
Okay, well, I dare you. By the end of today, I want KL to be designated as a smart city. Let's see what you can get done between now. What is it? It's about 10 to 11.
Yeah.
And 5 o'clock. Off you go.
All right. We'll be right back. BFM 89.9.
Ballsy football moves. BFM 89.9.
And we're back. It's Fun Friday. My name is Jeff Sandhu, and I've turned the studio into a smart studio already. Now I know how long Matt Armitage needs to speak and when he would stop and what he does and how what time he comes in.
He uploaded me to the cloud during the break.
There was a USB port at the back of your head, Matt. So it was relatively simple.
I know, but it's 1.0.
That's why we had a slightly longer break. But anyways, let's get back to today's topic. You want to talk about in U.S. Army, they are making a laser-powered drone that can fly indefinitely.
This is
scary here, man.
This is scary, but it's so cool. I think we talked a few months ago about laser weapons and all that kind of thing. And the U.S. military has kind of largely abandoned the search for laser weapons because they require so much power. It takes a long time for them to recycle and to make a second shot. So instead, they're using the lasers as a power source, which is quite amazing.
It's amazing, yeah. It's honestly amazing. It's like, you know, sci-fi, Star Trek, Star Wars kind of thing. But you know that it's U.S. military here that's building these drones that can fly indefinitely. That's worrying, though.
It is kind of worrying. I mean, the idea is that they can be used to protect convoys or to fly above shipping, that kind of thing. Yeah. So they can be powered. What is a little bit worrying is these are the kind of lasers that melt things.
So if
you're beaming it to the drone has to have a system where it actually dissipates the heat and takes the good part of the laser to turn into electricity and dissipates the rest of the heat. But also, potentially, if you miss the drone, I mean, admittedly, it's aimed in the sky, but you could potentially damage anything else that it hits.
Wow. I can't imagine like a bird just flying through this laser beam and just probably split into half.
I imagine it would be barbecued just a little bit. But at the moment, I think the range is only about 500 meters. So
that's still...
But I mean, it's not the kind of thing where... So there has to be a command and control module fairly nearby in order for it to work. But I can imagine this working... at a much greater distance once they get these kind of accuracy and heat issues under control. But it is, like you said, it is quite scary, this idea that above a US military base, these drones can just patrol and hover forever. Mm. You know, as long as that laser's on, they're never going to come down, because traditional drones are kind of limited to like half an hour or an hour because of the you know, the size and weight of the batteries.
It reminds me a little bit of like some of the games that I played from like Splinter Cell, and like, you know, your mission is to now, you know, deactivate these laser beams because they're the ones who power this, you know, the gating system or, you know, the drones now, right? So yeah, it kind of reminds me a little bit like a game.
That's the thing. I mean, the technology is actually getting ahead of a lot of the games, you know, in terms of the reality of these things. It is, like I said, it's cool and scary at the same time.
Mostly when it's cool, it's scary too. Mostly.
Yeah. what I don't really want is for those annoying people who fly drones above my head at concerts and things like that to have a giant laser, because I don't really trust them to be in control.
Well, the project aims to demonstrate a working ground-to-ground system by early 2019 and a ground-to-air in year 2020. So yeah, watch out. There may be laser beams in the skies in the future. Talking about skies, let's go one step further to the moon. Because SpaceX, you may have heard this in the news already, they have finally picked the first passenger for their BFR, the Big Falcon rocket, that will be sent to the moon. And it's surprisingly, it's someone relatively unknown, but he's a huge billionaire. It's, you know, like,
yeah, I mean, that's what got me about this story. It's good to know that any common, everyday billionaire can have the opportunity to go to space. I mean, it really is good to know that the ordinary working man billionaire knows that he can just pick up a phone and go to the moon. It's such a heartwarming tale for the rest of us.
Exactly, because if I'm not mistaken, he is the 18th most richest man in Japan. So we're not talking about globally. Globally, he could, you know, probably in like hundreds or something.
Yeah,
right?
I know.
So
he's probably like one of the poorest billionaires in the world.
Exactly. Yeah. So he only has a net worth of like $2.9 billion, according to Forbes. So, you know, nothing that much.
Really? I spent that much at Zouk this weekend.
He's also an avid art collector, and he spends, you know, millions of, you know, hundreds of millions of US dollars on paintings and stuff, which we all do on a weekly basis anyways, right?
Well, I mean, that's just because I charge you hundreds of millions for the paintings that I do at weekends.
Well, there's a demand. That's why you do it, right?
Yeah, so, you are the demand.
I am the demand, exactly, yeah. So the name is Yusaku Maezawa. He's a Japanese billionaire and the founder of Zozo Town. It's Japan's largest online clothing retailer. He will be the first private customer to ride around the moon. And the best part about this, though, and this is where probably me and you could come in here, Matt, because he's actually bought all the seats, the entire rocket.
Yeah.
And he wants to bring artists.
Yes, he's going to take 6 or 7 artists with him. He hasn't chosen who they are yet.
Yeah, because he's, you know, he hasn't reached out to us yet, but we're just waiting here.
So if you want to stand a chance, tweet me.
Yep, exactly. Yusaku Maezawa, if you want to send Matt Armitage, tweet Matt Armitage. He will get back to you immediately. Yeah, and I guess, you know, jokes aside, it's nice to see this billionaire who's going there not to just, you know, for show or for fun. He's actually helping.
Well, no, he's going for show and for fun, but he's actually extending it to other people.
To other people.
Which is nice, yes.
And it's free for the 6 to 8 artists.
I agree. That's really cool. And it does make you, because obviously he's buying these spaces from Mr. Musk.
Yeah.
So you do wonder why Mr. Musk, one, needs the money, and why he hasn't extended that to artists or people who aren't your average, everyday billionaire.
Exactly.
But, you know, that's another story.
You know, because he was saying, like, what if Picasso had gone to the moon? What if Andy Warhol or Michael Jackson or John Lennon, like, you know, of all these people, if they've gone to the moon, they may have been inspired by something.
What if Salvador Dali had been to the moon?
Hmm, something to ponder there, right? So he's having this project. It's called Dear Moon, hashtag Dear Moon. That's a website as well that you can check it out, that went live right after the announcement that's made. He's not just looking for painters. He's looking for any artist in any field. So you could be a producer. You could be a film director. You could be, you know, anything that could sort of tell that story or be inspired. He wants people to be inspired again. And you know,
I'm really excited to see what comes back. It is cool, but there is kind of a hidden line in this story, which is that SpaceX does point out that this trip may be dangerous.
Yeah.
Now, in the context of a giant rocket that is basically full of a bomb, dangerous means dead. It's like black and white with this. You are or you aren't. It's not. There's no Schrodinger's cat here.
It could also be a publicity stunt here, because
I don't know. I don't necessarily think it is, because
there's not much details here what training he would go through, because you can't just simply send anyone to the moon. It's difficult. You know, it's and plus, like you said, it's dangerous. What if something goes wrong? Then, you know, it's just gone. Like, maybe it's just Elon Musk being clever yet again, and maybe he called up one of his buddies and, you know, turns out to be this Japanese buddy.
I think it's real, but, you know, I can imagine if something goes wrong, the reaction's just going to be, it's a bunch of artists.
No, we will
it's
feel
the world's
really
poorest billionaire and a bunch of artists.
All right, let's talk about. Let's move on to Geek Tunes. What do we have for today? I saw the music video for this, and it's very interesting.
Oh, I haven't seen the video yet. But I really like the track. This reminds me of a band called Louis the 14th. It's just kind of scuzzy garage pop. I've always liked this kind of thing. It's very upbeat.
It's very raw as well.
Yeah, it's very raw. And also, it's kind of about technology and music. So the lyrics are kind of relevant. This is How Did This Happen by Bodega.
BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.